Thank you so much for that amazing introduction, and also for finding patterns which I hadn't actually realized myself going through the various books. I have been indeed very interested in the Turkish encounters of various kinds, both peaceful and violent, and I guess that is a theme that is very important in my work. But this is also finally the end result of 12 years I've been working on this book. It took much longer than I thought it was going to take, because I never realized what a landmine it was when I went in. And it was very hard for me to find a way in which to deal with all the issues. And that was quite trying, but it was also very good for me in the sense that I was able to find and make many friends, and those others I didn't agree with. So it was also a very important chance for me to self-reflect. And I've been especially happy to come back to UCLA because thanks to Professor Hovhannisyan, who invited me from early on. I still remember when we came, you know, and he introduced me, there was the silence, and he says, yes, she's a Turk, and come and hear what she has to say. And, you know, I don't know if you remember that, but so I have had a chance to be with the community, at least in California, from early on, and I have learned a lot, and thank you for giving me that opportunity, and Professor Hovhannisyan and now Yusuf. It's wonderful. I want to take you basically through the book and the main arguments I make. And I want to start by telling you how I decided to study what I studied, because I think it is important, but we don't get enough of that information. After getting tenure with the rise of the bourgeoisie, demise of empire, I was going to start my next project in the 1990s. And I was interested at the time, like many other social scientists, in the rise of Islam in Turkey, because that is when they started to come up. But the 1990s also marked the time when the military constantly kept intervening in the rise. And as a consequence, whenever I gave talks on the topic, people said to me, well, if you want to figure out what's going to go on in Turkey, you should actually study the military, not the Islamists, because they seem to have more agency. I knew that was not a very good idea, because whoever studied the military disappeared in one way or another. So instead, I said, why is it that Turkish state and society welcome violence, in this case political violence, so much? Why do they accept all these military interventions? And that got me thinking about how violence has become normalized and naturalized in Turkish society. And I said, there must be a foundational violence for which state and society have not accounted. That is why it has become normalized and naturalized. And I said, and what could that foundational violence be? And that is when I started going back in Turkish history beyond 1923, and guess what? The foundational violence I hit upon, of course, was the Armenian Genocide. And that is how I came upon to study that violence in and of itself. The issue, of course, for me was not that whether what had happened to the Armenians was genocide or not, because that was, I assume that was, of course, the genocide, and that wasn't. What interested me as a sociologist was why the Turkish state and society denied what happened. To me, for me, that was the more important question. And that is why, rather than only focusing on the 1915-17 period, I knew there were instances of violence before in 1894-96, such as the Hamidian massacres, and I knew there was a continuing of violence against the Armenians after the genocide. As a consequence, I was much more interested in how the pattern of genocide, pattern of collective violence against the Armenians started, how it transformed, and how it ended. And you know, that is why I chose 1789 to 2009. 220 years, and historians pass out when they see this like huge, you know, thing. But I'm a sociologist, so I can get away with it. And I think that made things both difficult, but I think also for me more informative. And that is what I will be taking you through today. Why 1789? I mean, I will explain this in a little while, but that is. I draw upon Zygmunt Bauman's arguments regarding modernity. With the introduction of modernity into Ottoman society through reforms and other similar innovations, I think the relations within Ottoman society became polarized. And the representation and the legal issues went from being communal to being individual, which I think unfortunately decreased the protection that communities had within the legal system. And that polarization in turn through emotions and you know, public negotiation of the emotions led to certain, you know, to the collective violence against the Armenians. So 1789 is, in addition to being the French Revolution's auspicious date, the date when Selim III, Sultan Selim III, came to the throne. And that is when systematic modernization in the Ottoman Empire started. So I knew 1789 was the way to start. I also knew from my own experiences of living in Turkey that the prejudice and discrimination against minorities continued to the present, but I had to stop somewhere, otherwise, you know, you cannot write a book. And that is why I chose 2009, because it was a nice round number, and it sort of went with 89, and therefore I covered the 220 years. And that is why. Now, if we take this one then, my starting point was the contested memories of 1915. If you look at the standpoint of contemporary Western scholarly community and the Armenian diaspora, the Armenian genocide is one of the first genocides of the 20th century that occurred during 1915 to 22 or to 17, however you want to put it, with the intent to annihilate. Intent is, of course, very important, between 800,000 to about 1.5 million Armenians. If you look at the standpoint even today of contemporary Turkish state and society, it is not a genocide, but reciprocal Turkish and Armenian massacres with unintentional destruction, largely due to travel conditions of Armenians deported from the war front due to military security during World War I, leading to 100 to 400,000 Armenian deaths and at least 1.5 million Turkish wartime deaths. And of course, this official historiography tries to minimize the Armenian deaths while maximizing the Turkish ones. And of course, it's 1.5 million because they basically bunch together all the soldiers, the civilians, and the military officers, and you know, that died during the war at the war front. This is, if you know, you know, historical analysis, trying to compare apples to cauliflower, because obviously it is not the same. In the Armenian case, those who were destroyed were almost exclusively civilians, women, children, elderly, whereas of course the 1.5 million deaths are mostly soldiers. But this gives you a sense of how, in this official historiography, you see how they manipulate the facts in a way that do not reflect what goes on. Still, the issue is, why is it that, as I say, the research question, why do Turkish state and society deny what happened to Armenians in 1915? What does this denial entail? When did it start, and when will it stop? These are big questions, but at least I ask them to see where it would take me. If you look at the sites of memory through which I could study this, most of the people study official state and government documents. And they do so on the assumption that these documents are somehow objective. But they are not. They actually interpret events and things that are going on from the standpoint of the state. In a sense, they are, of course, as critical theory, the critical school, the Frankfurt School would say, inherently biased in their own. And in addition, they do not at all deal with the meaning of what it means, what violence means, what it stands for, and you know, how it has been interpreted by people. It is much more interested in the structure, in the institution and institutions and how they deal with violence. And for that reason, I decided not to use only official state and government documents. The other three that I could use were Turkish and minority literature. Especially minority literature has only been started to be translated in Turkey in the last couple of decades. So there is not enough material out there, because for denial, in order for me to document it, I wanted to study things that were written in Turkey, in Turkish, that were available to the Turkish society, and they that were not nevertheless used by them, because I didn't want them to come and say, hey, you know, how would we know those documents? We can't read them, they're in Ottoman, you know, we would have no idea of what was going on. But had they read this memoirs, they would have known what was going on, and as a consequence, it was important for me to work with documents that, or texts that were available to the general public. There are, of course, oral histories, accounts, interviews, but these also have been starting to take place in the last decade or two. You probably have heard of Fethiye Çetin's book. Ayşegül Altınay is also doing a lot of oral history, as is Leyla Neyzi, but those things also have been happening in the last decade or two. As a consequence, I decided that it would be best if I did a systematic analysis of contemporaneous, mostly Muslim Turkish memoirs. And this is also significant with respect to the Turkish official stand, because they usually claim that the Armenian eyewitness accounts, you know, of the survivors, in addition, the Western accounts, they say are all biased because they are not written from the standpoint of the Turks. This way, I figured I could tell the story from the Turkish, you know, from the literally voices of the Turks, Turkish mostly officials and officers, quite a number of them young Turks. And about five or seven of them are actually members of the special organization, Teşkilat-ı Mahsusa, so that it would be an account that could make sense also from, you know, that what the Turkish official stand would have a very hard time countering. I also was, I also made sure that I contextualized what I did across time and space. I was, of course, very much interested in how the past impacts the present, how the internal and external forces interacted, and also how the structural elements that people usually look at, institutions, organizations, communities, groups, interacted with cognitive processes. Because whenever you talk about things like denial, emotions become extremely important, and we cannot not study them. So that for me was important, that people, you know, really cared about these issues. Because in most contexts, many societies have a lot of social polarization in them. But that polarization doesn't always translate into violence. For that to occur, there has to be some emotional engagement. And that is why I was interested in the emotions as such. And another thing that I observed was whenever I talked to especially diaspora Armenians about what had happened, about the genocide, you would get a sense as if it happened just yesterday. I mean, it was so still a life for them. I mean, and you know, they sort of weren't able to have any space from what had happened because of the denial, of course. They were not able to acknowledge what had happened, come to terms and start the healing process because it was denied. Because people argue denial is the last stage of genocide. If you talk to instead the Turks, they would not want to hear of anything. They did not know much as to what happened, and they didn't want to talk about it either. And that, of course, also, that silencing also has very strong emotional components, and that is why I wanted to focus on those. As a consequence, I focused historically then analyzing the course of Ottoman Turkish history in relation to the contemporary denial of collective violence, 1789 to 2009, and empirically I decided to do in-depth textual investigation of 307 memoir writers, that meant 356 texts because some people wrote more than one memoir, penned by mostly Turkish Muslim officials and officers. And that was, I basically studied and collected during the, you know, at least for a decade, all the memoirs I could get my hands on that were printed in Turkey in Turkish. I read through probably about 700 of them. I collected and made notes and translated into English all instances of any narrative that involved any kind of violence, talked about the Armenians or other minorities and, you know, conflicts as such. And that is how I ended up with the 356 texts, and I had, when I was done, about 1,000 pages of single-spaced, you know, documentation. And of course, because I had so many, I could put the pieces of the puzzle together, and as a consequence, not only was I able to understand what happened, because a lot of the memoirs corroborated one another, but I could also see what they left out. Because usually in conditions of propaganda or, you know, ideological discourses of the Young Turks, of Talat Pasha or, you know, others, or Cemal Pasha, their memoirs, what is just as significant is not what they say, but what they leave out. And this way I was able to see how they use the silencing very strategically in a way to legitimate and justify what they were saying. So that was a major advantage for me. If you look at the theoretical framework, as I said, the European modernity interacted with the Turkish one and the state of society polarized, but how did the collective violence against the Armenians occur? I think here public emotions and the way, you know, they interacted with the polarized society was important in generating the collective violence, but one would have expected after collective violence for it to be acknowledged. Why was it that state and society did not acknowledge and instead deny what happened? Here I have the sort of bold argument of using Bill Sewell Jr.'s eventful approach. I argue that certain events are used, interpreted, and sort of twisted in ways that somehow lead to denial instead of acknowledgement. And that, I think, is sort of the important thing. And the result is, of course, collective denial. So in the end, and I'll spend more time on this, this is what I came up with. Very complicated. Well, not so hopefully, but I came up with four phases based on the violence committed against the Armenians, collective violence. There were always instances of prejudice and discrimination, but the first is the 1994-96 massacres, then 1517 ethnic cleansing is the way they have referred. Then there is, of course, in the Republican period, the 6-7 September 1955 pogroms were committed against all minorities, but there were also many Armenians who lost their lives and their wealth during that. And then the last instance is the 19th January 2007 assassination of Hrant Dink. And I also see all of this then as continued violence against the Armenians, that I wanted to understand how it happened. In phase one, I think how modernity starts shaping society and state becomes very important. Here we see military modernity, where it is the military, Ottoman military, that starts, the army starts to get modernized first. And what happens is that there aren't any minorities in the military. And as a consequence, obviously, the modernity with the minorities, especially in this case the non-Muslim ones, start taking place around trade, especially trade with the West. And there is a significant polarization that happens within the Armenian community during this period, because those Armenian, mostly merchant families living in Istanbul, Izmir, mostly, major cities, are those that are able to enrich themselves. And the Sultan and the state has no problem with that, insofar as they remain apolitical and they do not convert that economic power to political power. And then they are given many medals, so the Bolis Armenians sort of have a different reality than those living in the eastern provinces, especially after the 1850s when the Kurds are being settled, because those Armenians start losing a lot of their lands and the lands of all the monasteries and churches to the Kurds and to others living in those areas, and they become increasingly impoverished. But I think there is very difficult a lack of correspondence between what's going on in the East because of all these issues, the Armenians living there and the Armenians living in major centers. In the West. And that, I think, is one of the reasons why most of the massacres take place in Asia Minor, and why also the Armenians are unable to all come together to make a united stand. In this context, what is very interesting is that there is denial, and I'll talk about that, but the 1895 Ottoman bank takeover is a very interesting event that the state is able to use, the Ottoman state is able to use, to argue that Armenians are actually being constantly sort of egged on by the great powers, and that is why the Armenian problem emerges. What they do not see, of course, is the actual domestic origins of the Armenian issue. It's basically the failure of the Ottoman reforms of 1839, 56, and 76 that lead to the Armenian issue. But the reason they do not is that during the 1895 Ottoman takeover, which is one of the first urban sort of instances of terrorism, so to speak, a group of Armenian revolutionaries take over the Ottoman bank. Then the bank director intervenes. They go to the Sultan. The Sultan says it's okay for them to leave. They leave the building accompanied by the Western officials of the bank. They get into the yacht of the director, and then they go to France, basically. And Abdulhamid II says, see, they were instigated initially from the West and they went back to the West. I mean, you know, and they use it then as an occasion to deny the domestic origins of the Armenian issue. And this is something they still do to this day. They always, argue that all those who in the Everything that goes wrong in Turkey and all instances of violence, they say, are planned in the West and externally produced when they're not. I mean, so this is the first layer of denial. The second one is, of course, the Young Turk phase. And here, the military, the modernity is political. This is when Western-style institutions, ideas are introduced into Ottoman society. And here, you start having the divide within Ottoman society between the alaylı and the mektepli. Alaylı being those that have not had formal schooling, but that have been learned things through experience, and those who were trained in Western style schools. And they are, of course, those basically are the ones that are the origins of the Young Turks. They get Western style education and they say, we know what is good for the country and we will do it and we don't need the Sultan. And they come up, of course, with the constitutional revolution in 1908. They take power over, and of course, in this case, what is very significant is that the genocide that happens is extremely systematic, and it is done in relation to modernity, and not only that, most of the actual leaders, the perpetrators, are high-level officials and officers, and more significantly, quite a number of them are doctors. And that sort of, they see this as sort of excising cancerous cells from the body politic. I mean, you know, and that is, I think, a very modern way of doing it. But there also is, of course, another layer of denial. Even though the intent is to destroy the Armenian presence in their own ancestral lands, they say it was like this was just a sort of population transfer that went awry. So they take away and hide that intention and deny it. And why do they do that? I think the Balkan Wars are very important because it is during the Balkan Wars that the Ottoman army thinks that it's going to win these amazing victories in the Balkans. And all the Ottoman officers are supposed to say, put on their ceremonial uniforms because they say you're going to, you know, conquer these countries so quickly, you'll have to be at the centers, you know, in like 24 hours, so you better be dressed in your best outfit. What happens is that they literally are destroyed in like 3 weeks and they lose their shirts instead. I mean, so that is a very unexpected defeat. And in addition, right before the war, the great powers say, the great powers too are so certain that the Ottomans are going to win the war, they say whatever the boundaries are will stay the same. So that, you know, whatever the war is, everybody will keep what they had before. The problem is, once the Balkan powers, Balkan states win a lot of land, the great powers change their argument and say wherever the cross goes in, it stays and the crescent does not. So as a consequence, the Ottomans feel, especially the Young Turks feel, they're double-crossed by the great powers. They are extremely upset. And that, unfortunately, radicalizes the nationalism within the Young Turks. And since they cannot take on and destroy the great powers, they instead destroy what they see as the representatives of the Christians among themselves. And they go after, therefore, the unprotected, their own subjects and citizens, and aggress against the Armenians. So that is, I think, how the rationalizing event sort of changes the whole dynamics, and again, I think, leads to denial at the second level. The third level is when we start the independence war, at the end of the First World War, the independence war, independence struggle starts until 1974. This is extremely important because one of the reasons, actually, that the independence struggle starts is to stop especially the Armenians and the Kurds from establishing their own states in the East. And as a consequence, Mustafa Kemal and his cadre specifically do not let the non-Muslim minorities to participate in the independence struggle. Because they do not participate, they never can become a part of the body politic once the republic is formed. And that also, of course, excludes those groups from the republic once it's established. And in that context, the most significant modernity is educational. One of the first laws that are passed when the republic is established is unification of education. They unite all educational systems and they literally whitewash history. Atatürk's speech, the one he gives in 1927, becomes the official historiography of the Turkish Republic. In that historiography, there is no mention of what happened before 1919, that is the start of the independence war. Therefore, the whole genocide is swept into prehistory of the Turkish Republic, and also the history is whitewashed in such a way that Turks appear always to be the innocent, good-hearted people, and everybody else is basically the enemy. And that, of course, changes the history and with it destroys any information of all the violence that the Turks committed in their own past. And social polarization that starts occurring within society, because it is very important that once the enemies sort of are destroyed, in addition then to the Armenians, there are other internal enemies that are defined, such as the Kurds, later the Alevis, and that cycle of destruction and violence continues. What is very important in this context is the denial of the survival of perpetrators into the republic with impunity. Those who actually commit most of the violence against the Armenians are actually high-level officials and officers, but and local notables in addition. But what happens is that when the Allied forces, when the Ottoman Empire loses the war and the Allied forces take over, they start the military tribunals to try the perpetrators. And when they start chasing down and imprisoning the perpetrators, a lot of them escape and join Mustafa Kemal Atatürk's independence struggle, because you either get imprisoned and who knows what the British will do to you, or you throw in your sort of, you know, luck with Mustafa Kemal and see where that takes you. And what happens, of course, is that when Mustafa Kemal wins the independence struggle, the former perpetrators become the heroes of the Turkish Republic. As a consequence, their past and the violence in their past is whitewashed. Who are some of these people? Two are very significant presidents. The second president of the Republic, İsmet İnönü, is one of them. Not only is he a member of the Union and Progress, but he is also a member of the special organization, the Teşkilat-ı Mahsusa. He actually is the money bags of the organization, you know. That's when this whole sort of secret funds, for paramilitary activities, he is the one in charge of all of that, and he becomes, as you know, prime minister at some point, and then president for a very long time. Celal Bayar is another similar prime minister and president. And what happens, of course, is that all of these perpetrators, not only are they not punished, but they instead are rewarded by the republic. And as they then become officials of the republic, what happens is that they then take the violence that they have applied to destroy the Armenians, to then destroy later the Kurds and other internal enemies. And that is how I argue the continuation of denial continues. In this case, of course, what's important are the September 1955 pogroms that take place, especially in larger cities, to get away even, to get more of the wealth that the non-Muslim minorities had in Turkey. And guess who is the president at the time? Celal Bayar. So you can see how that cycle reproduces itself. In this context, it is very interesting if you look at the nationalist narrative. The 1923 military tribunals were the tribunals where all of the perpetrators that they were able to catch, at least, were tried. Most of these, in some, if you look at especially, they only were able to hang about less than a dozen people, perpetrators. But in addition to those that really perpetrated the crimes, they also, in one case, I think unfairly hanged the Mutasarrif of Urfa, Nusret Bey. And it's interesting because I was reading the defenses. Nusret Bey says, look, I collected the Armenians because I was told that I took them to the border of my jurisdiction. They were all in good shape. I gave them over to the you know, Mutasarrif of the next jurisdiction, and that is when they were massacred. So I am not responsible, he says. So he makes this argument once, he is tried, and he is acquitted. Then they try him for the same crime a second time. He gets 15 years of kürek, so it is like a heavy, hard labor, yes. But then he is tried a third time for the same crime. And in the third one, there is one dissenting judge in this group of judges. So the head judge, what he does is he removes the dissenting judge, appoints another judge that agrees with him. They all decide to hang him, and they carry out the sentence within 24 hours. Now this, whichever way you look at it, is obviously the sort of wrong, it is not legal, it is not right what they do. What happens is that the Union and Progress people and all the nationalists hang on to this one instance and say, see, this was not legal, this was not just, and this is what all these military tribunals were about. And they dismiss the whole issue, and with it, the Armenian genocide and the perpetrators. And they say, hey, we all have been tried, some even have been executed unjustly, and the Armenian issue is finished. So that, I think, is important in demonstrating how that is when the Armenian issue is sort of completed and finished, at least from the Turkish national imaginary. If you look at the last phase, this goes from 75 to 2009. And what is significant in this context, of course, are the justice commandos of the Armenian genocide and the Asala assassinations of Turkish diplomats, where about 36 diplomats are assassinated over this time period. And that is why I think it is another phase, because what happens when the assassinations occur, especially the first one in 1974, here, occurs where two consul generals are killed. The U.S. public prosecutor gets in touch with the Turkish foreign ministry and says, give us some information on what the Turkish official stand is on what's going on, because Yanukyan says he did it because he wanted the world to recognize, you know, what went on with the Armenians and how they were destroyed. They look at the time, and according to the memoirs of many retired diplomats I also read, at the time, the only thing they have on the Armenian issue is this one little tiny brochure in English, and they have nothing. And then they say, oh my God, we have to write something about this. According to Kamuran Gürün's memoirs, they then call all the scholars to Ankara and they say, okay, academics, Turkish academics from various universities, they say, we want you to write something demonstrating how violent Armenians were throughout our history. Go and write it. And then Kamuran Gürün says, and these scholars, they're so crazy, not only did they not obey our orders, they tried to tell us how we should be doing our own business. So basically, the scholars don't do anything and they go back to their universities, but Gürün is desperate to have some literature produced. Guess what he does? He calls into action all the retired diplomats. He says, go into the archives and research this issue. And that is how we end up with the official Turkish historiography on what happened, done by people who are not historians, who go there not to study what happened, but instead to find documentation to demonstrate the violence of Armenians against the Turks. And as a consequence, they come up with this extremely rhetorical sort of explanation of what happens, focusing much more on what was the violence of the Armenians, and in the process relativizing what happens, and therefore basically the final phase of denial, and of course these all build on one another, is the responsibility of violence committed against the Armenians. They basically shirk the responsibility, saying it was mutual massacres. That argument comes from the interpretations of these retired diplomats. And when we as Turkish, other progressive Turkish scholars, do not take this official Turkish historiography into account, and when we do not invite them, especially those of us living in the West, to conferences, they say it's because of the strength of the Armenian diaspora that, you know, the diaspora stops them from being invited. They do not realize we do not invite them because they do not do scholarship academically. This is not scholarship, basically. It is propaganda. And that is sort of, I think, what continues. And in this context, the main violence, of course, that unfortunately happened is the one against Seren Dink, which to me demonstrates the fact that even though there were many of us in Turkey trying to change things, all of us except Seren were white Turks. We were educated Turks, and we wanted to change things for the better in Turkey. And among us, the only one who got killed and assassinated was Seren, and he was assassinated because he was an Armenian. And I think that, to me, demonstrates that the prejudice and the discrimination and the violence still continues to this day. Not only that, even though he was assassinated in 2007, to this day, the people who ordered the assassination have not been brought to justice in Turkey. They are still at bay because, unfortunately, the roots of such thinking and prejudice go straight into the state, to officials and officers working together within the structures of the Turkish state. So that is why it continues to this day, and my argument is it is hard to understand and come to terms with this denial because it has built over time, and rather than each phase questioning what happened before it, it instead built this denial narrative on top of one another. If you want to see an example of what a memoir looks like, here is one memoir of Naimeddin Ener Binak, whose father was Ahmet Ener, and there Ahmet Faik Ener. And it is very interesting because in the first paragraph we learn who the father is, but she is depicting him as a nameless hero, even though this person we find out here was held responsible for the deportation of 27,000 Armenians. So he was definitely one of the perpetrators. But the interesting thing is, of course, with the language you just think it's deportation. No, I mean, he belonged to the inner circle. He was a perpetrator, and he literally massacred the 27,000. But nevertheless, you know, he engaged in that, but what's interesting is that afterwards he never engaged in politics to become a state official ever again. What is interesting is that there is the mother at the same time, who also had an experience, but it was very different from the father's experience. My mother Aisha was 18 years old when she traveled with her manservant to Antep in 1915 to join her newly wedded husband, who was the Mutasarrif sub-district governor there. She used to narrate their voyage as followed. We were passing the Gavur Mountains by horse carriage, mountain on one side, precipice on the other. People on the roads were migrating. Many elderly children, women walking in the asphalt air, some so much covered with flies, you could not make out their faces. Some took a couple of steps, fell and died. Many begged to get into the carriage. One woman attacked my carriage, crying, "Let me be your slave, take me." Serenely, Albany. People died while talking, at nights, while walking. At nights, children's cries of my Rick rose from the tents. It was terrible. We had fallen right into the middle of the Armenian migration again. But this was obviously, she personally witnessed the destruction and the violence that was being done. So there are two different experiences, her seeing the violence and of course the father committing the violence. Then years later, when the father was 84 and the topic of the Armenian deportation came up, my mother said something against it, yet my father, who had been lying calmly in his bed, suddenly came alive and, pounding his fist against the comforter, said to my mother, "If I were born again, I would have done it again. Do you get that, Aisha? I would have done it again." Even in his last minutes, whenever a national issue came up, he became alive and cried up. And this, I think, demonstrates how nationalism and sort of the ideological approach to this led to the silencing of much of the violence, and how within the same family you had all these different experiences. What I did was, I hadn't, while I was writing the book, I collected all the eyewitness accounts, the Armenian memoirs, but I didn't read them because I did not want them to sort of, you know, interfere with what I had found from the memoirs in Turkish. Then at the end, I read all the eyewitness memoirs. The interesting thing is there is 100% correspondence. It's the same narrative when you look at it at the level of memoirs. So in a way, by looking at the memoirs, I was able to go beyond the official historiography and demonstrate how the violence was experienced, both from the side of course, not the victims, that has been done many times, but from the point of view and vantage point of the perpetrators. And I think that is what is so interesting. Ever since I have done this, I gave a talk on this topic in Turkey, in Istanbul, the beginning of October. Just this talk I gave to you in English, I gave it in Turkish. There were about 120 plus people at the Tarih Vakfı, and there was not one dissenting voice. They just asked questions about this, that, and the other thing, but they totally sort of accepted it. And then they had a long interview with me in a newspaper. Since that, I'm getting emails now from people, descendants of perpetrators, interestingly enough, who just have found out about what happened, and they say, how could we now live with this violence in our family? Because our families are cursed. How could we get over this curse? I mean, you know, so they are worried about, of course, that. And I have other people who then say to me, we know this happened. We're glad you're right about this. We apologize to you. And I say, I'm not the one you should be apologizing to. I just wrote the book. I mean, you know, you should apologize to the Armenians. So I don't know. I'm hopeful in certain ways because the younger generations are much more aware of what's going on. But in other ways, of course, I'm also pessimistic because unfortunately this government also continues the same denialist policies. But there is probably about 10 to 30% of people in Turkey who are sort of acknowledging what happened. And we hope, and I hope personally, for the betterment of all of us, that percentage increases in the years to come. Thank you.